Blog Talk Radio.
And welcome to another episode we have here of Suspense Radio. I am your host, John Robb, and today we have a great show for you. 60 minutes coming up here. We're going to have authors, writing team, father-daughter, John and Caitlin Stewart, talking about their book, Hiding in Sunshine. And then coming up is going to be author, screenwriter, psychic medium, Robbie Thompson, speaking about his book that is coming out. So we got a lot of stuff going on. 60 minutes of Suspense Radio begins right now.
Welcome to my nightmare. I think you're gonna like it. I think you're gonna feel you belong.
Thank you, everybody, for joining us today. We are going to jump right in here with our first guest. It is a father-daughter writing team. The book is called Hiding in Sunshine. It's hidinginsunshine.com is the website. So we want to welcome to the show here John Stewart and Caitlin Stewart. Guys, thank you so much for coming on. How are you doing?
Good. Glad to be here.
Me too.
So like we said, so Hiding in Sunshine is the book, and this is the first collaboration that you guys have done together. So tell us a little bit about the book that's really like not on the back cover, something like a little bit inside, maybe kind of the conception of how you decided to write this and, you know, what a little bit of it is about.
Sure. For how we started to write it, it was a couple years ago, Christmas 2010, and my older sister had received her first credit card, and it was just a family dinner, and my parents were letting her know about all the risks that come with having a credit card. And we were just talking about it for a while, and I kind of asked my dad a question, what would happen if half the family or someone in the family lost their identity through credit card or any type of theft, identity theft, and especially what if the parents lost their identity but the children did not lose their identity? Who did the children belong to their actual parents or to legally to the people who stole the parents' identity? And my parents didn't really have an answer, and they didn't know, and we tried to find information and answer the question, and there really wasn't anything on it, and that's kind of where the idea really germinated about identity theft. The story itself revolves around a family whose identity does get stolen, and they are put into the witness protection program. It's their story on the run for 11 years and the trials that they have to go through this loss of their identity. And it has a parallel story. There's a story of the family and their journey and their lives, and there's also, on a more national level, the threat on the nation through cybersecurity and cyber warfare, and how that can affect the entire country as just how, and the level of hurt and destruction that can occur through cyber attacks and cyber warfare is as similar to the level of destruction that can occur to a individual family through identity theft.
And, you know, when you're talking about a subject like that, right now it's a big thing in the news. I mean, just the other day I was driving to work, and on the radio I hear that people are saying, you know, the world is no longer, or the United States is not going to be hit by bombs. It's not going to be hit by, you know, things like that. It's going to be hit by cyber terrorism, and that's the one thing that people need to worry about, because it's very difficult to detect. It's very difficult to stop. So when you started getting into this and researching it, you kind of almost feel scary to the fact of that it's almost so easy for something like this to happen. What were your thoughts when you started to get inside the book and you started to research and see everything that was going on, you know, just from a personal standpoint of yourself?
That's a fascinating question. We started working on this book now nearly about 2.5-3 years ago when the concept started, and cyber attacks and cyber terrorism was not as much in news. The book was published actually 6 months before even it started making the news. And now last week alone, Michelle Obama's personal identity was revealed and the details, and same for Joe Biden, same for Hillary Clinton, Al Gore, director of FBI, Eric Holder. The list is long. If you think about it, if people at the top echelon of the country cannot protect their own identity, what about rest of us? And so it is absolutely scary when your social security number and date of birth is out there, and for the whole world to see and people to impersonate, and the damage they can cause. It's a serious, serious issue. We are at a point where what we were thinking about in the book as imaginary situations and clearly work of fiction, and the boundary between fiction and reality started to blur by the time the book got published, and now the reality sometimes is appearing scarier than the fiction
right.
itself, and that's real danger.
Yeah, I mean, you know, when you did hear of Michelle Obama, Joe Biden, Hillary, and all those people and, and their information, I think the scary part to me is we've kind of turned the humanity outside of people, and now we've all made ourselves electronic because we're all typed into all these types of different things. So when you start exploring all of those types of facets and the bigger picture that this encompasses, you got to kind of feel a little bit humble to the fact. And then when you start writing a book like that, you got to feel kind of emotional, a lot of emotional connection, because this could literally, you know, happen to anybody more than the regular kind of thriller where, you know, the serial killer picks somebody out. I mean, the odds of that are much, much less than what you have written about here in the book, Hiding in Sunshine.
Oh, you are spot on. I mean, it could happen to anyone. Any one of us can be that victim, and the odds of that any one of us can be a victim actually are extremely high. What just happened to all these eminent people, including Joe Biden and Michelle Obama, is they apparently lost that from a credit bureau of some sort, or somewhere where the credit reports could be accessed. Think about it. If the folks who have stolen all these big names, don't you think that they have everybody else's name if they wanted to? Which means that we are already at a much higher level of exposure than that we ever were. And to a degree, we feel kind of that we foretold this in some sense. So there is that sense of satisfaction that at least we are trying to, in addition to it being a work of fiction, it's trying to make folks aware of the perennial danger we are living in, and the volume of the danger just got ratcheted up in the last 6 months to a much higher height. Retiring the ex-Secretary of Defense, Leon Panetta, said this is cyber attacks, or he called it cyber Pearl Harbor. The only difference being Pearl Harbor was localized. This could happen to anyone across the entire country in the mainland. And when people start using those terms, and he says could happen to anyone, director of intelligence, I think last week said, this is the biggest risk country faces, higher than any risk, including nuclear risk.
And so when the two of you sat down and decided this was kind of the subject that you really wanted to explore, then how did you guys go ahead and then begin to start tackling the characters? Because your main characters here are Gavin and Lisa Brinkley, and you had to now wrap yourself up in there. So did you kind of guys use, like, your own family as kind of a basis for creating these characters? How did you guys kind of go about creating, you know, the characters that were now going to be involved in the plot of what you already had the basis of?
Right. So the basis of the movie, the cyber attacks kind of happen along the way in the book, but the book is actually about a family, and where the protagonist loses and the wife and the children, they lose their identity and they are on the run, and the people who stole their identity are after them because the key character actually is one of the top cybersecurity experts. And it's really a family saga on the run for 11 years out in America, in the western part of the country, in Idaho and Montana, who is facing every conceivable difficulty. Just all their sole goal in life is to stay alive, and how they come together. So story, main story is about that, and I'll let Caitlin answer the rest of the question about how did we come about and so forth.
For the character development, I think we've drawn on both our life experiences. I mean, they're not, there's no particular person that any character is based off of, but really we tried to put our minds in situations that they are in and reimagine the emotions that they would feel and what actions would come through those emotions. So they really are fictionist characters, but as authentic as we could make them, and really tried to put in the authenticity in both their situations, the setting. We did research through someone we knew about how even like the government systems and the witness protection work, so to really make them authentic characters.
Yeah, what was kind of like your biggest challenge? Because did you guys write books separately before, or is this kind of each your first book that you ever wrote, even though it was a collaboration? First book total. So what was kind of your difficulty challenges when you guys both sat down and it was both your first books, and, you know, when you have two people that maybe have a little bit of different ideas how to kind of get to the end point, how did you guys have to balance that out when you decided that you were going to sit here and write it? Did you guys kind of sit here, did one of you maybe take the lead on a certain area and then the other one kind of come in, or how did you guys have to work through all that?
So a lot of things I would write a chapter, my dad would read it and put his input, and my dad would write something, and I would read it and work with it and synthesize it. And from the beginning, before we really wrote the book, we had a skeleton or an architecture of the book, kind of, but we knew where we wanted it to go. So with that in place, we could really kind of work and expand and play and pull with the storyline and the actual smaller plots within the story. But I think the writing styles was something that we really had to work with. My father, he is an engineer by trade back in the day, so he writes with shorter sentences and really good at writing with concise language. And I personally enjoy writing in a more fluid and flowery style. So I think combining the two, making it concise yet interesting to read and gripping story was one of the harder challenges. But from the feedback we received, we've been told it's been a pretty good synthesis of our two styles.
And I want to remind everybody, we're speaking here with the father-daughter writing team of John and Caitlin Stewart. The book is called Hiding in Sunshine. HidingInSunshine.com is the website. And so then you guys go ahead and you start writing about cyber terrorism, you start writing about identity theft, you start getting involved with it, and then the time comes to when you're like, okay, let's send this out, let's see if anybody will actually read it. What was that feeling like? Was one of you a little bit more nervous than the other to see, you know, because everyone gets rejection letters. I mean, people, all the authors I've ever spoken to, heck, they put them on their wall and they actually use them as a badge of honor now to see if they can get to 100 or whatever. But how was that coming about once you finally wrote the end and you're like, all right, Dad, or, you know, let's see what we got now. What'd you do?
It was a feeling. We were quite nervous. We were not sure. We thought that we had done a good job. We were not sure whether it's a subject that will appeal to people, considering it relates to identity theft and protection of privacy and cyber attack. It kind of is off the beat subject. We, I believe, are the first book which touches on the subject at such an in-depth level, especially the cyber attacks. So we were quite concerned at the same time. We were convinced that it's a good book. very nervous when initially the reviews started coming at Amazon. It took like a month to get 10 reviews. Fortunately, they were very good. But then things started to pour in, and now we have over 200 reviews, half of them are 5-star, and 90% of them are 4 or 5-star. So that was a great vindication. We feel much better today, but we were very nervous and concerned that maybe, and you know, when you spend 2 years of your life building something, a lot of emotional involvement in it. My daughter and I were working closely together. At times there were differences of opinion. She was maybe felt strongly more strongly about something, and I was kind of, well, I'm not sure. And it just was a lot of effort, blood and sweat had gone into it. And then when you put it out and realize that there's a risk that all of it may amount to nothing. And it's that,
right.
It's that sense that really unnerving. And yes, we did go through that process for some time.
And
thank
now,
God it's behind us.
Yeah, and now you have to do, you know, wonderful shows like ours and press shows and blog shows and everything else. And you probably weren't used to maybe having to put yourself out in the public eye, but in today's day and age is how the authors are doing it. So did you guys kind of have a plan for all of that when you were finished and when you started writing and when it was all done? Or is this really just so all new to you that you're just still feeling your way through the process of not just the publishing but the marketing and now becoming an author?
It's all new to us. We are still learning the ropes. We are raw when it comes to marketing. I have engineering background. I've never marketed before. I always used to think that if you do a good job, good things will happen and nature will take its own course. Clearly, it's not necessarily true all the time, but on
right.
this one, at least we have been fortunate. We got the opportunity, for example, an interview like this, where folks can hear us and decide for themselves. One of the things we have done is price the electronic version of the book at $1.99, so much wider audiences can read it. And we wanted to have fun while writing a fiction, but at the same time, I really believe that it will increase the awareness rather dramatically and people will benefit with it.
And Caitlin, on the website, it also mentions that, you know, this is what you want to do. You know, you're a student, you're an aspiring writer, and now that you are an author, what are your plans kind of going forward? I mean, are you guys going to write together again? Are you going to maybe do something on your own? What are your plans going forward now that you have been able to kind of realize your dream by becoming a published author, a book that is fascinating, getting great reviews right out of the gate?
I think my dad and I, we worked pretty well together. I mean, we had some ups and downs, but I think it was a great team, and we both add different insights that made the novel richer. We kind of just talked a little bit, and we're thinking this summer we might start launching and thinking about writing a sequel, or at least a book with that uses some of the characters and kind of adding to the story. So we might do that together. So I think our joint team will continue, but I think in the future I might also write some things on my own. So we'll see what the future holds.
Now, what kind of genre is kind of your passion? Like, what do you read or like, your favorite authors, thing that you know, that you really want to maybe get into and write and explore yourself?
I'm also actually really interested in short stories, and of all types. I recently just finished Dear Life by Alice Munro, and her stories are phenomenal. They're beautiful, and within the short story, the emotions that they carry, and with such a short amount of time, and really bringing the reader in to understand a certain trait or a certain characteristic or a certain personality or a certain theme that you can really hone in on one specific feeling that I think is more difficult to do with an entire novel. And I've also been reading Joyce Carol Oates and her short stories. So I think maybe even diving into the short story world will be another area.
And so, John, kind of the same thing for you. I mean, how was kind of your journey going through? Do you think that maybe you want to maybe break away once and maybe explore something on your own intend to write or anything else like that? Or something different?
I'm happy
or
to play
a
supporting role to my daughter, who's, I think, a much better author than I am. And although I'm a big fan of Dan Brown and Tom Clancy, but I think I will let her take the lead, and I'll follow the lead.
So you're more not going to have any inspiration of kind of saying, hey, I'm going to do this on my own. It's going to be more the collaboration and then bringing, more of these kinds of stories to the fan and to the reader.
Yes. Look, I mean, how many chances one gets to spend so much time with their kids, with their children?
Yeah,
and
true.
I'm very
yeah.
fortunate to have this opportunity, so I want to prolong this forever.
Yeah, I mean, I can understand that. As my daughter, oldest, is getting married in 2 weeks, that's always like, wow, yeah, you know, what's going to happen now? Because now she's kind of leaving the nest. So, I'm with you on that one. I get you. Got to draw that one out as far as you can.
So true.
So what kind of events are you guys, going to? Are you guys going to bookstores? Are you going to shows? Are you going to be out and about meeting fans? You know, what was the first time when you were out, at a book signing event or at some kind of place where you were sitting down and meeting fans face-to-face? What were the kinds of things that they were asking you, or what were the kinds of things they were talking to you about? How did that all go?
We had a book reading session, and it was interesting because this was the first one we had ever done, and we had no idea. And somebody brought a question about very detailed, very specific question, something about passport for someone, the character in the book, and how did that occur. And I was surprised that somebody was paying such a close attention to that level of detail. We had an explanation why we did it that way. People ask us questions about cyber attacks quite a bit. How secure is my bank account? One of the readers said that after I read the novel, I check my 401k every single week. And rightfully so. Another one actually said that they had 3 charges on their bank statement made out to some automotive place, which they had never actually had occurred. And they called the bank, and bank took care of it. So that was a classic case where, and it's happening much more frequently. So people are bringing more of their real-life experiences and their fears of what's going to happen. And this was before the big news about FBI being hacked and Department of Justice and all the big brand names, including Vice President and Michelle Obama getting hacked. It's just more scarier, but people are very concerned about this, what's happening. Nuclear war was kind of far off. Who knows, it was an abstract notion. Cyber war is a real thing which could be happening to people today, and they're not even aware of it.
So what would be the one thing right now to the listeners that are sitting here and they're wondering, and they're going to pick up the book, they're going to read it because, you kind of have the underlining part of maybe how to protect yourself or how to do those types of things within the book. What would you tell them? This is the one thing that you should probably start looking at and getting into a habit of knowing just about yourself and about how to protect yourself.
Sure. First thing is, don't give out your social security number and date of birth absolutely online. Just avoid it to the farthest possible extent, especially if it's in response to a text message, an email message, or a phone call. Just protect it to the utmost possible extent. Treat them as if like they're treasure, because through that people can empty your bank account. Second thing is, keep a printed copy of a monthly statement, as retro as it sounds. If there is a cyber attack and money has been wiped out from your account, you at least have an evidence that you had that money. Nobody keeps physical stock certificates these days, but keep a monthly or quarterly statement of your mutual fund so that people know that that's what you had. At least there's a paper record of it. So some of these things may sound retro, but they are actually very, very useful in terms of what one can do. So those are some of the things want somebody watch out for. There was a virus recently, by the way, which was turning cameras on, effectively involuntary webcam going on, where somebody was watching your activity all the time. So there are a lot of these things, so make sure that your security software is updated. That's one of the most important things. So there are a number of these events, a number of these steps one can take to guard themselves.
Well, I want to tell you both. I want to thank you so much for coming on. Again, everybody, this was John and Caitlin Stewart. The book is called Hiding in Sunshine, and it's hidinginsunshine.com is the website to check out their debut book. Look for them also in the future to see what else you got coming out. So please stay in touch. Let us know what else you have coming on, and I want to thank you both so much for coming on today, and much success in the future to both of you, Caitlin. Let's see you maybe go and see what you can do on your own. You just never know. We might see you in 10 years on that New York Times bestseller. Who knows?
Well, fingers crossed.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
So, thank you so much, guys. Enjoy yourself, and we will talk with you later.
Take care. Thank you.
Okay. Bye-bye. So, again, everybody, that is the father-daughter writing team of John and Caitlin Stewart, and the book is Hiding in Sunshine. We are going to be back here now with our next guest right after these messages. He is author Robbie Thomas, and he is going to be sharing a couple insights about his work and a lot of the other things that he does. It's going to be a fascinating listen, so don't delay because you got about 4 minutes. And so in the meantime, you can hear this. Welcome, everybody, back here. This is Suspense Radio. I'm your host, John Robb. We just had fascinating listen to with John and Caitlin Stewart in their book, I do want to remind everybody that this today's episode of Suspense Radio is brought to you by none other than Simon & Schuster Books, because there's very little peace for a man with a body buried in his backyard, let alone three. So read Three Graceful, the acclaimed debut novel by Jamie Mason, available wherever books and ebooks are sold. You can visit jamie-mason.com for details on more of that information. We always like to thank Simon & Schuster and their imprints that they do for us. And fascinating reads. That's all I can say. Fascinating company. So right now we want to welcome our next guest here onto the show. He is author Robbie Thomas. Well, he's a lot more than an author, but let's just say author now. RobbieThomas.net is his website. So, Robbie, thank you so much for coming on. How are you doing?
I'm doing great. Thanks for having me.
So we talked a little off the air. You said that you had just, you know, put out four books here in the last year. Can you give us a little bit about, like, the books are, because, I mean, when you have such a, you're such a diverse person, I mean, with so many different things that you got going on, I mean, your books can encompass, like we said, you know, we could talk for 2 hours to 4 hours on a lot of the things that you've done. So give us a little bit about the books that you have released in just in the past year.
Absolutely. I've started out with the first one, Time Shift, The Paradigm. It started out to become a movie script, and I had a couple of great producers, directors involved, such as Mark Tillman, who worked on It with Stephen King, and he's done MacGyver and different programs from the 70s all the way up. So I was writing the script, and things were flowing very well into Time Shift, The Paradigm. Now, it's an end-all apocalyptic-type view of a book, but it has a inspirational meaning to it, which has a twist. So as things were flowing, I don't know how to say it. It's like a living history, because what has happened, synchronized throughout the book, there's been a turn of events, and six major, if you would call them premonitions or visions, if you will, have come true. On the onslaught of the book and between the script and the book itself, where I took a little break, I made mention on a public forum of chaos and depicted a terrible happening going to take place around the world from March 2nd to the 10th of March of 2011. Also had a conversation with the producer and said, I'm going to implement 9.0 earthquake off the coast of Japan with a tsunami, and then it transcends from there. They loved it. They thought it was fantastic. So on March 11th, as everybody does know, it actually did happen.
Yeah, it does.
From that, yes, and from that moment, go back a week, there's the very first vision, if you will, that was written into this book and time-stamped and correlated and corroborated with producers. Now, come full circle and bring you right up to speed to what happened in Russia just recently, of the comet going across, or the meteor, sorry, going across a certain region. I named the region in the book. The book was released in the 8th of May of 2012. This just occurred. I give the region and the name of the city. The last four letters of the city I gave was Domensk, and Chernomensk was the actual place where it happened. So the letters are very similar. I use the word in the book of the Russians are going to point the fingers at the Americans, blaming HAARP and blaming, which I name the Solaris program, that the weaponry, they're going to blame that on. And sure enough, they did. And it's in the news that they were pointing the fingers at us over here. Now I went a little bit further into the book, and I mentioned names, and I said Igor Vladimir. Well, on the pages of 40 to 43, it depicts this whole scenario of what took place. And the gentleman's name in the book is Igor Vladimir, but the gentleman's name in real life was Vladimir. His son's name is Igor, and he runs the campaign or the party of Vladimir in Russia. So, you know, you're getting into that type of transcending visual aspect of that book itself.
Now, when you sit here and when you have these visions that come about, you have to put them down on paper. And do they, I mean, because I always kind of wonder, because, you know, I don't have any kind of ability even close to that. But do you see pictures? Do you see things in your mind? I mean, does it come not kind of as an A to Z, but more like an A and then maybe goes to W and then back to C? And then you have to kind of piece those things together when they kind of just come upon you.
Yeah, you know, it's like being, it's like watching a movie. If you're sitting there watching TV with your family, and it's like watching that. When I do a murder case, and I worked with different law agencies internationally, you know, one case in Kentucky in 2007, I visualized, and the boy was showing me what was going on, and he gives me the murderer's name, which is, the murderer's name was Cecil. It's not a Bob, a John, or a Mary. His name was Cecil. And depicted where he was, the outskirts of his home, the surroundings, that he was a repeat offender. And when we relayed all this information quickly back to the police, they went to arrest Cecil New. He took off, went on the lam, but they caught him, and he's in jail since December 6th of 2007. So it's like watching a movie. It's not so much like piecing it together. It's like watching an episode, and you're seeing the whole thing visually, and you're writing it down, you're keeping notes, and it's like automatic hand drawing, automatic visualization put on paper. You're right.
And, you know, I mean, of course, that would, you know, you have a lot of, like I said, you have a lot of people, of course, you always have your skeptics out there. I'm a very, very, very firm believer in ghosts and the supernatural and the things outside, because there's just too many things out there to, I mean, when things are right in your face and you fail to look at them, that's your own fault. And they've been in our faces for a very, very long time. And so when you start writing books like this and you start bringing them down, do you kind of have to, you know, like you said, you just had a murder case, you know, of a little boy and things like that. How emotional does those kind of get, especially with the families? And if you weren't able to help in those things, I mean, how does that affect you emotionally, just on those types of things?
Oh, it affects me tremendously. I mean, I have children, and I'm married and family. Just going back to the 9.0 earthquake, when that happened, my stomach fell, and I looked up to my wife, and she, you know, she was distraught, because we just went through the whole week of discussing of putting this script together and how it was flowing. Then the phone started ringing from the producers from Hollywood, and it was just an onslaught of, you know, oh my gosh, look what happened. And then again, going to the murder cases, it's depleting, if you will. There are happy moments. I mean, I've found people alive, and we've traced and retrieved a young girl from the human trafficking trade. My website, as you mentioned, RobbieThomas.net, there's endorsements from police agencies there. There's letters from families who explain in thorough of all the cases I've done, news clippings and what have you. And when we brought Kim's daughter home, she explains in the letter, you know, the police were at odds. They didn't know what to do. They could not find her. They didn't know what to do. And I just, you know, made mention of certain things, what we should have done, and they did it. And it just so happened that those people were watching and let her go on a Friday, and Sunday night she had her daughter back.
Wow. I mean, so when people come up to you and they don't know you, and they're going to see your work and they're going to read your books for the first time, where's a good place that you kind of tell them to start? Because, I mean, you have so many fascinating reads, you know, that you've written, you've done so many different things. Where would be a good place for them to go ahead and start, you know, figuring out who Robbie Thomas is and what you write about and what you're about?
You know, I look to the one book called Signs from Heaven. Not too many, you know, I don't like using the term psychic, but, you know, that's an identification of people who know what you do, psychic, medium, or what have you.
Right.
The government of Canada endorsed me. They endorsed that book, which was fantastic, and the story in there about Noelia. And at the time, the Canadian government got involved, and I was speaking with the White House of America, the Portuguese government, the Vatican, many different entities were involved in trying to save this woman's life. And now people are going to say, how did you get involved? It was the will of her spirit showed up. And I'm in Canada, and she's in one of the islands off the coast of Portugal. And so, you know, you take it from there, and you're thinking, how did that work out? it was just, it was amazing. And, you know, to see the government bodies cutting through the red tape immediately, issuing visas, and the flights were given for free. Doctors were going to donate all their time. And, you know, to find out what I do and to work for a humanistic way, I think that book right there would be the best. You know, I've written in many different genres. I've written horror, thriller, inspirational, factual fiction. I just take it because I just love life, and everything that I do write, regardless if it is fictional, is part factual, because the horror genre I wrote in is a part of all the years that I've worked in the paranormal field, being either in movies or being working with integral different people on television, and, you know, just stemming it right into a fictional line story.
And so what is, like, kind of like your true path? I mean, are you very, do you really like writing more of the fictional stuff to kind of maybe get out of your zone to can just be totally imaginary, totally, you know, away from everything that, you know, that I guess, you know, hits you in certain, because you don't know when you kind of get these things, you know, these visions and these things that kind of come at you. Is that kind of like what you like writing? Does that make you happy when you kind of write those things and makes you fulfilled when you're doing fiction?
Yeah, it's like you say, it's a way out. It's my way to become, you know, away from the reality and interject myself into a fallacy world. So in doing this, I create the characters and the persona, but I'm taking traits of everybody that I've worked with over the many years and implementing those into the book form. And then again, it becomes, you know, part of me, and I've lived it already, so I'm reliving it, but I'm just adding to the story, giving it a little bit more flavor.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, I mean, I know you've probably been asked this 100 times, but when did it kind of all begin? When did you kind of get the sense that you had this gift that was different than anything else, and that you needed to share it? And what was, and you know, what was like the first maybe case then that you really put yourself into that people said, yeah, he's just, it's not true, he's not doing anything, and then you were able to make them believe?
Oh, you know, several. I'm just looking back now, you know, in time. One time I was standing in the parking lot with a friend of mine who was a superintendent of an apartment complex. And I seen this individual walking across the parking lot. Now, this goes back to about 1990, 1991. And I'm noticing this black shroud around him. And I've seen energy around people before and what have you. And Greg turns to me and he goes, oh, that's Jesse. Would you like to get to know him? And so we ended up somehow into Jesse's apartment. And I just knew there was bad about this guy. And I went through to be a police officer twice. So my line of questioning at the time, being younger, you know, the bravado and the ego of that type of person I was back then, was I wanted to be a cop so bad that, you know, I'm streamlining these questions at this guy in his apartment. And he asked me to stand up, so I did. And he goes, are you effing hot? And I didn't understand what he meant at the time. I was taken back by what he was telling me. And he lifts my shirt up, so then I knew. He was looking for a wire. And he pats me down, and he pushes me down in the chair. Yeah, it was amazing. I mean, if you can picture a guy sawed off at 5 foot nothing, and he looked like Eddie Van Halen, this was his replica. I kid you not. And
Eddie
so
Van
I'm standing
Halen.
There.
Yeah.
And so I'm standing there, and I'm sitting there, and then he goes, you want to know? He goes, we were ripping off a car stereo across the way. And he said, Thomas Cook, who's in jail now, who murdered again, who saran wrapped his girlfriend, watched her die just, a few years ago back. Well, they went to this little cubicle where Mark Campbell was working, and his family just moved from Quebec to Ontario, Canada. He was a high school kid, you know, just making money at night, going working at this gas station. He said, Thomas took the gun out, and he was popping them like a rabbit. He says, you should have seen him hopping. And they were explaining to this to me in this fashion. I just couldn't believe what my ears were hearing. So as we left, Greg and I, he warned us of not mentioning this and that he was going to get off on a technicality, and he just knew the whole thing. I went down, and of course, you know, I called the police. The detectives wanted me to wear a wire, and go back in, they knew what I was talking about. They wanted me to befriend him one more time and get this information on a wire. And I said, are you kidding? He had me made. He felt me up. There's no way I'm going
right.
Back. So that would be the very first instance of my very first case working with or in conjunction with the police. And I tell people, please, do not put yourself in harm's way. Do not do what I do. It was a foolish thing to do this, and it just led to a career where I am now, which is not foolish, but, I mean, that was the wrong step to do.
Yeah, that had to be scary as hell.
It was. It really was.
I couldn't even imagine something like that.
Yeah, you're looking into the eyes of someone who has no soul, and you know, the
darkness. I've done that before, but
right.
She was my ex. But but I just can't imagine kind of, you know, that kind of feeling. And I mean, I'm trying to sit here and think, but I mean, I couldn't imagine. I mean, just your heart rate and things alone, and trying to keep yourself calm. Trying to keep all those things under control has got to be so difficult. In the realm of everything that you're involved in right at that time?
At that time, it was. I've grown to know
more.
You've
grown to get better, though. Yeah.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I mean, I've been on where I've interviewed and sat with detectives, you know, holding the recording tape or the tape recorder and looking at these guys calling me Mr. FBI, one guy in Kentucky, and I'm telling him, you know, I know it was you, and then halfway through he admits it. I mean, you know, it's amazing because you call them straight out and there's things that they don't know that you know. I mean, they think you don't know, and you're just calling them on it, and it's amazing.
Right. You know, and so let's switch here a little bit because, you know, let's go kind of to your fiction work because you do have a trilogy that you're writing, Parasylum, and the Unleashed book two just came out here not too long ago, actually just about a month ago, and it's something that you decided, you know, to do. What were kind of, you know, was behind that? Because Parasylum was your first book that you did back in September and 2012, and now you have Parasylum 2 coming out. So what's the basis kind of that trilogy? Did you know that you wanted to write a trilogy, or was it something that once you got it going on the first one, you realized that it had to be a trilogy?
Yeah, you know, this all stems, and it's funny, here's the segue. I was brought to do or help out in on the Natalie Holloway case, the girl went missing in Aruba. Now, on a radio show. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
And a radio program asked me, along with a producer, and they were going to film it. They happened to know the liaison for the family and wanted to send us over there. And then it got cut short because everybody was over there combing the island. So the producer says to me, what do you want to do? I said, well, let's make my movie called Ghosts and Legends, so which turned out to be Dead Whisper in 2005. So from that movie stemmed a book that I wrote all the factual events of behind the scenes of Dead Whisper I was in, the Sally House movie I was in, and many more places throughout North America I traveled over a decade. That book went out in 2006. I knew that I was going to write a fictional side of that, given the fact of the factual, and I just waited and waited. And so when the time came to, I started writing it in 2010-ish, Parasylum. And 2012 comes Parasylum. Now, I've taken, again, the derivative of the factual and placing – I've been in a lot of different asylums. I've been in a lot of speakeasies. I've been in – Al Capone's speakeasy was in the Dead Whisper movie. You know, I've been in a lot of institutions and what have you throughout America and Canada.
We say you've been in a lot of institutions researching, though, right? We don't want to say you've been in a lot of institutions.
Yes, we better watch our words. Yes, absolutely.
Okay, so go ahead.
And so taking from where I've been and, you know, like Manitino State Hospital as being in film, not being institutionalized, but putting that into the book form, Parasylum 1. Now, the derivative of every character that's been involved in the filming of that are actually on TV now still in different programs, I put into my book form and just lent that little bit of, you know, stickiness and scariness to the story, twisted it like crazy. And then we get into Parasylum 2, which is now the gangster part of where I was in Al Capone speakeasy. I was in Moundsville prison where I went with a bunch of people from Sci-Fi Channel and what have you. And I've taken the derivative of all that and made it into the gangster era and how the ghost of yesteryear come back to claim vengeance and what have you. And it's twisted like crazy there. Now, the third one is I actually went to the Azores, and I've been in different islands on the Azores many times before. And this is where Noelia comes in. After Noelia, I went over to visit and take a look at these islands. And it's phenomenal. So I got to know the people there who are very spiritual and very, you know, there's hauntings over there as well. So I'm going to incorporate that into my third installment, which hopefully will come out in 2014.
Now, and so you mentioned that you were with, like, some of the sci-fi people and that you were, you know, doing a lot of things. Have you run across, okay, because there's 85 ghost shows on TV. How many of them are truly real, and how many of them are set up? Because I know producers from Hollywood and different shows, and there are different shows that are reality that are staged, like 100% staged. People think they're real, but they're not. So, I mean, have you come across, I mean, can you sit there and honestly say that, you know, a lot of these, yes, they're real, and they're just not screwing around, you know, with people? Because I don't want to waste my time anymore.
You know, you said 85 shows?
There's a ton.
Yeah. Well, you know, every one of them shows are entertainment value only. That speaks volumes right there. I've been in this for many years. My very first paranormal investigation, which I brought people from True TV, A&E, Sci-Fi to my hometown to see where I did my very first paranormal encounter in 1977. So that takes me back that far. You know, taking a look at, I've been asked to be in shows. I've turned them down just for the reason you mentioned. They're all hand dealt. You know, if they capture something, they capture it. And then, you know, that's kudos for them for that program. But you're right. It's 100% entertainment value.
Yeah, and that's kind of what I was afraid of because, I mean, I still think that, you know, for people who don't believe in the extraordinary, the things that you do, and again, we're speaking here with Robbie Thomas, and RobbieThomas.net is his website. So many books to mention. We'll just say, you know, Parasylum trilogy out, Time Shift, The Paradigm is out, a lot of different things to check out. But I still think that it's ignorant of people to not think that these things don't happen, that there are ghosts. There's too many explained things, like I said, that people do have abilities like yours that can see different things. But people still not choose to believe these, and I don't get why. Is it because they're scared? I mean, is that it? Is it because people are scared about that?
No, it's the acceptance. People don't like the inevitable. A lot of people tend to shun away from what is reality of what can happen. I know a lot of people I speak to, they say, you know, I'm scared to die. I'm scared of, you know, living. Well, I say, you have to live first before even thinking about dying. So stop worrying about dying. Start worrying about living. You know, that's the great scenario and placement I can give you. And then people themselves, when they don't want to believe and the writing's on the wall and it's in front of them, it's not that they don't want to believe. It's just the fact that they don't want to accept it.
Hmm. Yeah, and I don't understand the reasoning behind, you know, I mean, I think that if you open your mind to many different things, that you'll enjoy living because now you're going to explore and see a lot of different things that you might not have just because you were too damn stubborn to do it in the first place.
Well, that's true. Again, you know, and the old adage goes is, you know, you can't walk with blinders on forever. You have that peripheral vision sometime come in. And when we look at an individual who is trying to, you know, sway away from not wanting to say, okay, that was a ghost or that was an encounter, I need more, I need the tangible, you know, I always say, if you're trying to keep your faith in check and you're questioning everything, you're doing a good job because you're actually keeping your faith in check. We as children, when we grow up, we don't see black and white. We see color. So when we get older, we get hardened. We become that cynic, that skeptic, and we really want that tangible so that we can say yes. Even if it is, you know, it comes in a dream. Here's a simple thing. Even if it comes in a form of a dream that you've had a visit from someone who has passed on, well, that's a visit because they know it's easy to entertain you in this fashion rather than just show up out of the blue and go, hey, here I am. That would freak somebody out. So, yeah, there's different, you know, ways we can explain this. But when we look at the whole genre of paranormal and spiritual realm and people who are trying to find that tangible asset to say, yes, I know and I accept, well, you're always going to have that one individual who will step aside and go, I just need that little bit more.
Yeah, I get that. Well, I'll tell you what, Robbie, I want to thank you so much for coming on today and speaking with us. Like we said, we could have gone 2, 4, or 5 hours on just the subject matter of everything you got going on. But again, RobbieThomas.net is where you can go find out a lot more information, submerge yourself into his world, into his works, and everything that you got going on. And we want to thank you so much for coming on and sharing some of that with us.
Oh, thank you for having me. It's been a pleasure so much.
Yes. All right, Robbie, you have a good one, and enjoy yourself.
Thank you. You too now.
All right. Bye-bye. So again, everybody, that is Robbie Thomas, and he author extraordinaire psychic profile of the whole nine yards he's got going on. And RobbieThomas.net is his website to find out a lot more information about that. We will say this, and I need to end the episode this way, is it's with a very heavy heart that Suspense Magazine, of course, we lost a very, very dear friend, not only an executive editor, but a very, very dear friend in Terry Ann Armstrong. 3 weeks ago, she passed away, and she will sorely be missed, not only by us, but everyone that she touched. So our March issue, of course, has a nice tribute and a dedication and everything that she has to her in there. And if you haven't picked it up and read it, you know, simply email us over. You know, you get 4 free issues. We can send it over to you. And it's editor@suspensemagazine.com to find a lot more out about what's going on. I mean, just truly a person who absolutely just loved life and everything about it. And so I'm going to end the show. I'm not really sure kind of, you know, how to do these kinds of things. But for right now, this is how it's going to end. And we will see you all later. Enjoy yourself, everybody. This one's for you. Terry, rest in peace.